So usually I try not to talk too much straight after meditation, but tonight there's so much I want, there's so much material, I'm kind of going to break that rule, so I hope that's all right to launch straight in after your meditation. So before tea, I'm just going to kind of give more of a general introduction, and then after tea we'll go into the specific theme, which, as I said, was non-hatred. So I'm going to tell you a little bit about what Sangharakshita says about morality or ethics from this book called The Priceless Jewel, which is a collection of Bhante's essays. Just a whole mixture of things, really. And this essay is called Aspects of Buddhist Morality. So, because we call this theme Beyond Ethics, rather intriguingly, perhaps. So I'll just sort of say a little bit that gives a flavour of what I mean, what we mean, Sila P and I, when we talk about beyond ethics. So Bhante says in this essay, he says there's two kinds of morality, or two kinds of sort of practices of ethics. And he calls mundane morality and transcendental morality. I don't know why that's making Sylvia laugh, but anyway. So mundane morality. So, and what he says, I wonder, yeah. Just wonder about whether to have a diagram. I might have a diagram. I get to see the Peter draws a diagram in a minute. So he says mundane morality, or mundane practice of ethics on the mundane sphere, that what that does is it brings about, you know, it's good for us, you know, it will have a positive effect, but it'll only have that positive effect within what we call conditioned existence, one's existence within samsara. Now, samsara is not a place. Samsara literally means to go round and round. It's like we samsarize when we just go round and round and round in a circle, yeah, in a sort of closed loop. But within that, if we practice ethically, we'll have, you know, we'll have a happier time in that closed loop, and other people will certainly have a positive effect on other people. Actually, maybe you could draw us a little closed loop. Or you can imagine one. But in leading the spiritual life, really, what we want to do and what the Buddha says we can do is we can get out of that closed loop, and we can move on to what we often call the spiral path. Yeah. So maybe you could draw us a little spiral path coming off, and whereas the closed circle just goes round and round, the spiral kind of reaches up unendingly. You know. So I like that image of the spiral. It's a traditional image. It's got no end to it. We can have a positive state augmented. It's an augmentative thing where successively our states of mind get more and more positive infinitely. There's no end to it. Even Buddhahood isn't the end. Even the Buddha can find more and more ways of being creative. So the question is, how do you move from this cyclic existence to this spiral existence? They are connected. They can't be derived from each other, but they are connected. One doesn't exist within the other, but they are connected. So as well as mundane, what Bhante's called mundane morality, bringing about a better life within the circle, it does provide a basis for getting onto this spiral, which is the transcendental path. Are there any questions on what I've said so far? Yes.
Does this equate with what Yanavacha was talking to us about, in the sense that the mundane path is the karma and that the transcendental path is the dharma?
So give us a flick back to the other diagram, Silapia. Yeah, very good. So this is the other model we've been using, those of you that have been before. So what we've got, just as Claire said, so that, if you look at it, this is another diagram, and it's quite good having two quite different diagrams, because it shows that they are only models, you know, it's not like literally this is, you know, our minds haven't got these pictures inside them. So this model is the same thing shown in another way. So here, this equates to the circle. You've got what we call the karma niyama processes. So karma means action, niyama means law. So this is us trying to practice ethics, and we're kind of starting here and trying to reach upwards, as it were, with our ethics. And this is the dharma niyama processes, which, as it were, are reaching down. And if karma is the natural law, which says that all intentional actions have consequences, then the law of the dharma niyama is the law by which human beings can become Buddhas, by which we can get off the wheel. That's the law that says in the other diagram we can get off that wheel and onto the spiral, that is possible. So it's as if we're reaching up with one, and the other is, it's as if that's reaching down to us. Yeah? So it is the same. It is the same sort of model, just in a different picture. And this wiggly line is indicating that there comes a point where this is a decisive point. Skillful action in this dotted line still continues after this point. It's just not willed anymore. It starts to just flow more spontaneously from us. And then we've kind of entered this stream of dharma niyama processes. Is that any questions? It's a bit theoretical up until now, but hopefully it'll become more concrete in a minute. So another, if I was to use another model, one which I quite like, it's a bit like you're trying to launch a rocket from the Earth, say. And for a while it's still under the influence of the gravitational pull of the Earth. So we're like a rocket trying to launch ourselves. So we're practicing as best we can, but we're still under the pull of greed, hatred and delusion that's trying to pull us back. But if we keep practicing enough, we can come under the sway of the opposite. It's like maybe if you were going towards the sun or something, you would come towards the gravitational pull of the bigger object, the sun, and you'll be pulled, at some point you'll be pulled along. But at first you've got to make more effort. So that's what Bhante goes on to say. He says, mundane morality, you need to make a constant, deliberate effort. But what he's calling transcendental morality, it says that doesn't require any effort at all. Yeah, it's completely spontaneous. So that's quite exciting, isn't it? I always feel excited that there does come a point where actually you've sort of broken free of that gravitational pull. So that would be what, if you were to look at the life of the Buddha, for example, or any awakened person, well, they would quite naturally, I think I was saying this in the first week, they would quite naturally respond to others with compassionate activity. It's like it would be impossible for a Buddha to feel ill will towards anybody, regardless of what was done to the Buddha or other enlightened person. They would quite naturally respond with metta. So they're the natural responses of someone who sees and knows things as they really are. Yeah, there's a question, sir. Yes.
Are you saying that it's basically a question of practicing something? And then, like, practice makes perfect. So you're just practicing, and like with anything, it's hard at first, but then once you practice enough, it becomes like second nature. Like,
yes, sort of. Yeah. Sort of, although that wouldn't, it's not, that's good, I'm glad you asked that, because it's not automatic, yeah? So you need, what do you think you need for that trans, so you definitely would need to be doing that practice, so to make that, it's almost like a leap from the karma niyama process to the dharma niyama, or it's sort of a leap to get off the wheel into the spiral. So what, there's a couple of things you'd need for that to happen.
Yeah, because it seems that there's something more fundamental that's required. It's not just a question of repetition. And then that taking over, it seems that there's something else that is a stronger pull when you get into, when you break a certain barrier. I don't know what that is.
Okay. Anybody want to have any guesses? It's quite a simple thing. Well, what you need is, on quite a simple level, you need to have faith that there is a reality beyond self-clinging, to some extent. It's not blind faith, it's based on that we may have little tastes of it. You know, I was only talking to somebody yesterday who's been practicing the Dharma for a couple of years, and she was saying, you know, she said, the whole world's telling me that, you know, to get on, I've got to look after number one, look after myself. But more and more I'm seeing that actually, when I start to care more for other people, that is a much more enriching, expansive way of life. So that's like a glimpse of a glimpse of that there is something beyond self-clinging. So you need to have and nurture that glimpse of a glimpse. Otherwise, no matter how much you practiced ethics, you would be, in a way, you'd only be a very good person. I mean, obviously that's a good thing, but you'll still be on that wheel, you know, you'll still be on those karma names. So you need that glimpse of a glimpse, and you need to nurture that there actually is a reality beyond. In a more sort of affective way, if you like, you need to, another way of thinking about it is you need to have an intense, a more and more intense desire that your practice was for the benefit of all beings. So that would be another way of approaching it. I sort of mean Yanavacha joke sometimes that our different temperaments give us different approaches. Like his temperament would be that cultivating faith in that glimpse of a glimpse, yeah? So in a way, his temperament would be almost to see and feel, as it were, the sense of those Dharma Niyama processes. Whereas my temperament would be, I start off more at the bottom, but try and make my actions as best I can, more and more for the benefit of all. In a way, they'll both work, you know, and they'll both overlap, actually. You can't have one without the other. So you do need that, and the practice makes perfect. But I think what you're getting at, there's got to be, something else has got to come in. So it's like cultivating faith and cultivating a sense of practicing more and more for the benefit of all beings. That will start to, it's almost like this should be 3D and they should be superimposed on each other. This will give way to this. But in this diagram, this reaches right down. So even from the very beginning of your practice of ethics, you could be a bit kind of not very good at your practice of ethics. But if you had that glimpse of a glimpse, you would be in the right direction according to the Dharma. On the other hand, you could be very good in a conventional sense, but if you refuse to admit that there was anything beyond mundane existence, you'd never be able to make that leap. Even though you might look more good and even be more good from the outside than the person who's in a way not that good at ethics but is trying to be open to that glimpse. And there's obviously trying to get better at their efforts. Yeah. How am I doing time on this? Let's just have a few more minutes before tea. So this is what we've been talking about in this 3-week seminar is what's called in Buddhism the three mind precepts in terms of the ethical precepts. So usually we talk about either the 5 or the 10 precepts. These are ethical precepts, which are the guidelines for a Buddhist way of life. So who can remember what the 5 precepts are? People familiar with them? I think a lot of you will be.
Generosity.
Yeah. Generosity, yeah.
Mindfulness,
yeah. What's that?
Loving kindness,
that's the first great ethical precept, yeah. Second one's generosity. Fifth one's mindfulness.
True speech.
Truthful speech, that's the fourth one. And remember the third one?
Sexual conduct.
Yes, abstaining from sexual misconduct, and in the positive form is simplicity and contentment. Okay. So they're the 5 precepts, and they're chanted in their positive forms, which you've given just now, and what you're trying to practice, and the negative forms, what you're abstaining from, so you're abstaining from taking life, from taking and not giving, etc. And they're chanted all over the Buddhist world, and here at the centre, and all you Mishras there who couldn't quite remember them all, they're when you become a Mishra, I'm sure you can remember them in their essence, what you're taking on to practice, you're really committing yourself to them. So does anybody know what the 10 precepts are? What's that?
There are the three that you mentioned, the kindness, generosity, and the simplicity, and there are 4 for speech. There are 3 of mind.
Yeah. So in the 10 precepts, there's just as Angela said, so there's the first 3, and then the speech precepts are expanded into 4. And then the mind precept is expanded into 3 mind precepts. And the 3 mind precepts are abandoning covetousness for tranquility, I purify my mind. Changing hatred into compassion, I purify my mind. And transforming ignorance into wisdom, I purify my mind. And in this community, the Tree Ratna community, at ordination, you take that set of 10 precepts as ordination vows. So you take the 10 precepts with the 4 speech precepts and the 3 mind precepts. But here's what Bhante says about this. I'll leave you this with a tea break. We might discuss it when we come back. So Bhante says, these 3 precepts, i.e. the mind ones, are not just precepts in the ethical sense like the others. They have a transcendental significance. They're oriented in the direction of wisdom, so their significance goes far beyond the social and cultural level represented by the 5 precepts. He says, to go for refuge effectively, you must intend consciously and deliberately to aim for the transcendental. Again, the transcendental isn't a place, as it were. You could say it's like we're talking about you've got faith that there is a reality beyond self-clinging, and you're orientating your being more and more in that direction. So he goes on to say, it's not enough to purify your actions, it's not enough to purify your speech. You've got to purify your mind, because only by doing so can you gain enlightenment, or can you enter the stream of those Dharma Niyama processes. Okay, so that's in a sense what we mean when I say going beyond ethics. Yeah? So you're going beyond ethics in the social and cultural level, good as that may be. You're kind of setting your sights much higher. So you're going beyond ethics in that sense, and also it's beyond ethics in the ultimate sense, that by the time you're a Buddha, you wouldn't even be thinking of ethics. You no longer have to practice ethics. You're just a spontaneous outflow of creativity and love and wisdom and compassion. So that's the beyond ethics sense. So let's have tea, and then we'll come back and get down to work on non-hatred, okay? Okay, so I might not say much more about that general introduction. I was just trying to set it in context. Unless there's any, is there any questions from anything before the tea break, before we go on to hatred proper, as it were? Yes, Ben?
When we do prostrations, and we can put the hands here and then, is that expressing the principles of right thoughts, and then the mouth, right speech, and then right, emotions?
It's interesting. What you're picking out is that the precepts, both the set 5 and 10, cover actions of body, speech and mind. That Buddhism is most definitely including actions of mind in when we talk about actions that are volitional and therefore involved in the karma niyama. And similarly, when we go for refuge to whatever level, we do that with body, speech and mind. And when you see people sometimes touch like this, as they bow before the shrine, that's body. So interesting enough, that's body here, speech, and then mind here, so mind. It's quite interesting, I was thinking that's in Buddhism, mind's located here. It's not our brain. It's more like our heart, so it's that heart mind. The Buddhist word is citta. Okay, shall I move on to the next bit here? Okay, so the precept, the mind precept that we're concerned with is changing hatred into compassion. So the last couple of weeks we've talked about, the other two, so we've talked about transforming greed. We did that the first week, and then last week we were concerned with transforming ignorance into wisdom. If you missed them, you can listen to them on our website, you can listen to the discussions. So we've got hatred tonight. So everything that I'm kind of bringing to you tonight is really the material of Sankaracharya's Subhuti. So if you're interested in this subject, I could really recommend on Free Buddhist Audio Subhuti's 2001 lectures on mind and mental events. So a brilliant, brilliant series of talks that he gave on a big order convention, a big gathering of several hundred order members, mind and mental events. It's about 10 talks or something. And then there's this book. It's a bit of a shame because this is out of print at the moment, Know Your Mind, but it will come back in print. So as soon as you see it back in print, do grab a copy. In the meanwhile, if you ever see it in a second-hand bookshop, that might be a good reason to go and help in Jambala if one comes. Because if you do see it, I would, it's really, really worth it. It goes into all this stuff in really good detail, the workings of the mind. Okay, so I thought I'd just start by a question. What is hatred? So what is hatred? I'll ask you, you can maybe see if the peer would be kind enough to Joe of Portland. What is hatred?
It seems like a really negative mental and emotional space.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
With maybe sort of potentially anger at its core.
Uh-huh.
Although it depends.
Okay, yeah.
And in my mind it's also there's a feeling of very much separation.
Okay. Uh-huh. Yeah, yeah, so it's negative, the separation. So that's the kind of, that's the nature of it, isn't it? That's what it feels like. And why do we hate, given that it's so horrible sounding?
Often
because
you've been hurt.
Ah, if you've been hurt. And, oh, sorry, the voice is coming from from a different person than I thought. So if you've been hurt, yeah, yeah. And what's the mechanism? What happens if somebody hurts you?
You feel intense pain.
Yeah.
And victimhood, and you need someone to blame.
Okay.
And
you hate that person. Yeah, yeah. And that's the key, isn't it? That you need somebody to blame. Because you could just feel the intense pain, doesn't it? But hatred's something, there seems to be a desire that we think of, if I can blame someone. It's interesting, we need somebody to blame. That's quite, to people, I'm sure it's quite a common experience. But it's quite interesting that we stopped a bit, like, you know, why, almost like, why do we need somebody to blame? It's a particular human characteristic, isn't it? I don't think animals particularly do that. They may feel pain, you know, and suffering, but it's a sort of desire for revenge, isn't it? It's a, yeah.
But it's more permanent than things.
Yeah.
Permanent, but it's a kind of more long-standing state, isn't it? Where you want to set up a sort of a ideology in your head that, you know, you're here and the hated person is there, and that explains all sorts. It's not just angry because, you know, you reverse your car into somebody and then you set yourself up for being there. It's more, it's more entrenched than that, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. And it comes in different forms, which we'll go into as well, yeah. And it's interesting, it's like this, and I think that's interesting, often what we do is we have these very intense, often irrational emotions, but then we create an ideology around them. Is that what you're meaning?
Yes, on the recent retreat, the two people I sort of felt I disliked, I sort of realised that what they had in common was that they had a lot of characteristics that I didn't like in myself. It was like there was some kind of gain for me in taking it out on them and constantly referring to them, thinking, oh yes, oh, there it goes again. I'm much better.
I know that. Yeah, but that's good, and it's good as well. I think what you're also pointing to is on retreat, we've got a chance to. I don't know if you'd agree with me. Your mind is a that bit slower that you can actually start to see that kind of mechanism playing out. Would you say the retreat gave you the?
I've stayed there long enough.
You can actually start to see the whole way it works, yeah.
I think that's different because that's more dislike, as you said earlier. With hatred, I don't think it always needs someone to blame.
Yeah.
It's a particular person who has hurt you over a long period of time until you get to the point where you wish, like, such ill will on that person. And it's also kind of embedded in fear because this person has hurt you so much you're actually terrified of them. And that's when you hate them.
So it's got those characteristics,
Isn't it also attachment? I mean, it's sort of creating a whether it's been love that's turned into something or something you just feel is so unjust and hate it.
Yeah.
You're kind of creating this bond between
That's interesting, isn't it? That we're often very, we're very tied up with the object of our hatred, aren't we? Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, there's often a lot of energy in that. Say when we do the metta-bhavana in the fourth stage, we can suddenly waken up again, can't we?
Yeah, sometimes when you fear, someone drains your energy because
because of that feeling.
Yeah.
So you feel weak and tired.
Ah, yes, interesting. I'll come on to what Subhuti says. I'm going to tell you a lot better in a minute what Subhuti says, and he says something. So let's have one more.
I think like hatred is this feeling of unforgiveness, of where it hits these certain emotions within you, and it's like it's an eruption of anger and all these different emotions that you feel, and you're wanting to kind of, like we said before, to blame someone. But it's just all these different things going through you through in the mind, like constantly thinking about what that person did to us and about pain, how that person could have caused another pain. And it's just like, I feel like it's this explosion that as beings we need to kind of keep it on a level and learn how to control it rather than cause this big conflict and this hatred towards another, because it's quite damaging for ourselves as well.
Yeah. That, and we're good. We'll come on to that. Is how we work with it. Yeah. How do? It's all very well to say like love our neighbour, transform hatred into compassion, but how do we do it? Maybe just make a note of that, and we'll come back to that. Over. So I'll take just one more, and then I'll tell you a little bit what Subhuti says, and we can see. Go on.
This positive attachment that I want football team to win, I won't get my happiness. So what is the negative attachment? And when I see the words mentioned, craving and hatred, then I sort of try to understand that hatred means I'm not wanting, I'm not wanting.
Yes.
Which is very much like a negative attachment to that thing, that person.
Yeah. In a way that like they're like the flip side of each other. I think it's Bantu who said hatred is frustrated craving. And they've both got at their core, well, in a way they both come from ignorance. Well, they all bite each other's tail, as it were, but we've got this illusion of us, of an I that we've got to protect. So we're trying to bring towards us things that bolster it up and keep out what we think will be a threat to us. So let me say, I'll tell you a little bit about what Subhuti says, and then that'll stimulate some more discussion. And I think it's more or less what you've all said, with another little bit added. So Subhuti on this lecture, he says, well, what is hatred? And he says, as you've said, in the first place, it's a reaction to what causes us suffering, or that we think will cause us suffering in the future, or that has caused us suffering in the past, yeah? And the response is, the reaction is that we hate the person who's harming us or who's the agent of suffering, and we want to push them away or even to harm them or eliminate them. And we also feel hatred towards the instrument of the harm and towards the harm itself. We just don't want it to be happening, yeah? We don't want the person to be happening. We don't want the whole situation to be happening. He says it's a desire to retaliate, to punish back, and to harm back. And I think this is the key. And I think in a way we've already touched on this. He says, in order to restore your sense of yourself. So somebody attacking you diminishes you, and you restore yourself by harming them. Yeah, so you're trying to get the sense of self back again. Do people recognise that, the feeling of being sort of diminished in some way? You've got to, your whole instinct is to restore yourself. You either, sometimes I was thinking you might harm them or you might harm somebody else. You know, you get that chain reaction as well, don't you? Like, the boss shouts at the junior, and then the junior shouts at their junior, and then they kick the cat or something. So, because somehow you've got to feel powerful again. You know, you feel like you've been diminished in some way. What's the book he goes on to say, and I think this is key. So he says you take an object and you distort or exaggerate its painful aspects and its negative aspects you blow those out of proportion and you minimise the pleasurable aspects. So that's the opposite. If people were here on the week of craving, craving, you're doing the exact opposite. You're blowing out of proportion the positive and forgetting the negative. So the kind of examples we were given in craving was like getting drunk. So at the time it's pleasurable, but if you forget that you'll get a hangover, you forget that, you know, under the influence you might do silly things that you regret. So you're blown out of proportion that way. And when we hate a person, like, what was that really good saying, that hatred isn't seeing the faults in somebody else, it's seeing only the faults. You sort of, you zone in on them, and it's as if, sort of, and this might tie up with the ideology you were saying, you want to see only the faults. Have you ever had the experience of you really hate somebody, how painful it is if somebody else likes them? You can, yeah. You can, it's like you want to gather people on your side somehow. You can't see anything good about them. And presumably that's because that feels like a threat to us. We can only feel whole if we put that person in the, they are ultimately bad. We say that's good. Do people recognise them? So that shows us, so it can be a bit of a, you know, that can be quite hard to hold, that we hate this person, and because we want to feel justified, don't we? We don't want to admit, oh, I'm a person that's in a negative mental state, you know. We want to say, no, I am right. They objectively are bad and evil. But then what do you do if somebody else likes them? And maybe even if somebody you respect likes them. Do people know that? It's a kind of it's felt uncomfortable, isn't it?
I think sometimes, like, the main problem is, like, you look, when you hate somebody or they've done something to you, that then you're just like, oh, I don't like you now. Yeah. But I think sometimes the main problem is you don't stop and think why they've done it.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And I think, because if you don't empathise with, like, why they've done it, then you just can't understand why they've done something like that. So then you're just like, why the hell would anyone do something like that bad to you? But then if you stop and try to understand why they've done it, you kind of think, you probably end up thinking that you've done something similar.
So that's another way, I think we're saying it's another way of getting perspective back. And the grip of hatred, your perspective is very narrow. All you can see is that bad thing they've done. And they may well have done it. It's not like, again, as we always say in the Metta Bhavana, it's not like we're trying to say, oh, you know, everything's nice and nobody ever does bad things and nobody ever hurts us. You know, people do hurt us, you know, or we do experience pain. Other people have been the agent of that. So, but you're trying to, I think, like you say, There's a bigger perspective, that there's the perspective that there's reasons for that, and also there's the perspective that there's more to that person usually than just that thing, you know. And other people can sometimes see that where we can't. So and that's quite an important distinction, that it's not seeing the faults. It's not turning a blind eye or looking at the whole world through rose-coloured glasses, but it's trying to see them in perspective. Yes, maybe they've done something, you know. Well, people do too, like outrageous things, you know. So they may have done that, but yes, there's reasons for it, and they probably do other things as well. And, as you say, we are the same ourselves, you know. So it's trying to have that perspective that holds both. It's what we would be moving towards if we're moving to non-hatred. So it's a distortion, Subhuti says, and a projection. And he says this interesting thing. He says it's an unreal consciousness. So it's unreal. It's not a true picture, that's distorted, and it disturbs us in body and mind. So it's not seeing reality, it's unreal. So how does that land? Does that feel?
Yes. But isn't sometimes sometimes is hatred always unnecessary and unhelpful? Because if it kickstarts a defence mechanism, which is necessary, and which is necessary, then that's not necessarily a bad thing.
So it's not a bad thing to defend ourselves.
Is it a bad thing to defend ourselves?
Well, I don't think so. I don't think necessarily. I don't think.
Hang on, just talk
one at a time. Sorry. Yeah.
I just wondered if it was confusing the issue of anger and hatred.
Okay. Yeah.
Anger is more of a reflex, protective mechanism, whereas hatred is when that anger festers and becomes more distorted. I just wanted to separate out.
And I think that's the key to it, that we can, that anger isn't necessarily negative. There's often a fine line. Anger can tip into hatred very quickly, but if we are aware enough, we can have anger without it going into hatred. So hatred is a definite wish to harm that's sort of extra to the wish to say simply protect ourselves or protect somebody else for that matter. There's an active wish to retaliate and punish in that, and that's the extra thing that makes it hatred.
But is it just retaliate? Sometimes perhaps you wish that person to be eliminated so that it just stops. Not because you want revenge, you just want that, and the only way it can stop is if they're no longer on earth.
The only way what can stop?
What they're doing. Like, say, Pol Pot and Hitler and Stalin. And,
I think there's always a better way around, like, defending yourself or something. Like, then, like, it doesn't have to be you don't have to attack the person to defend yourself. You know what I mean? There's always.
Yeah. Yes, because I think it can seem, I sympathise with that thing, it can seem like that, but what the Buddha's saying is that there is a more creative way, but that doesn't mean being a walkover, because I think that's our fear, isn't it, that if we don't, that we just end up we'll get annihilated, it's us or them. Mm. So we're trying to find a way that's creative enough to not allow ourselves to be a walkover, but to not add it, to not use more force than is necessary. So a few weeks ago, some of us are here, we talked about, it's a good teaching by Sangharaj, I think, of the love mode and the power mode. So the love mode would be you becoming totally from metta all the time. And the power mode would be where you have power, where you used power over somebody. And Sangharaj said, ideally you'd be coming from the love mode, but you can't always. Sometimes you have to use force, but you try and always let that power mode be sort of, sublimated. Sublimated to the love mode. And the way I see that is, in the sort of rule of thumb, is not using more force than is necessary. And that there may, as we grow and develop, you see, that's the other thing, that there'll be more resources available to us. Like, sometimes we can only say, well, either, like, you know, it's either me or him or me or her. But if you read even stories of the life of Buddha, or you read the stories of some amazingly developed people, they find other ways that we might not have available to us yet, but with the practice will change our consciousness, and we will, like, you know, the Buddha managed to stop murderers in their tracks just by the power of his metta. So he didn't need to kill them, because the force of his metta transformed them. Now, we're not a Buddha, probably, and we might not have such a force of metta, but sometimes we might have had a little glimpse of an amazing thing happening that we never thought, you know. Like, sometimes I hear when people have been practicing the metta bhavana, you know, people that they've never thought there could be a reconciliation, there is, you know. And then you start to see that there are more ways than were previously available to us. Does that Do people have people had any experience of, you know, they've managed to find a way through something that they didn't, maybe with a difficult person or that they didn't think? Yeah, were you going to say that?
I think it's important to put hatred. I mean, when does ill will become hatred? Is a long sliding scale.
Yeah, can we just stop there? Because I just wanted to. I was thinking.
Yeah, no, I'm going to just answer the question. I thought it's important to put it within the scale because it goes from annoyance to hatred over time. As this lady said, it takes time to build hatred, and it's fueled by anger, and it takes a lot of energy to maintain that. And then it seems it takes quite a while to unpick that as well. So I don't think you can necessarily turn that around overnight. It's a process to kind of head back down through that scale, you know, maybe trying to bring the person towards a kind of a neutral, so you're not necessarily going to love them, but they become more neutral to you, you know. And I think that's a very positive.
It is, and I think you're right. I think it can be sometimes. I think sometimes hatred can take a long time to build up, and maybe some temperament. Sometimes it can be in a flash. Like
I wouldn't say that's hatred, I would say that's anger.
Well, I would say it was hatred. Like, I have felt in a flash that somebody's done something, I felt in a flash that if I had something, you know, I could throw it at them, you know. I think that's like fury. I think fury is hatred. And I felt sometimes in a flash it can be undone. I remember, I just want to say there's a spectrum, which we're going to come on to in a minute. That there's different manifestations of hatred. Like sometimes we can gradually unpick it, or sometimes that thing that gives us a new perspective can happen very quickly. Like I remember feeling ill will, and it definitely wasn't just anger, it was ill will, it was a desire for revenge with somebody. And then I got the news that their mother had suddenly died in the night, and in a flash I felt meta for them. It dissolved the ill will. So that happened, so I think sometimes it can be a flash, and sometimes it can be a long process. Yeah?
I think it depends how it took to build up in the first place.
Yeah, know. I think it does, and I think there's different forms of it, which we will come on to. But I just wanted to come back a bit to that thing of, I was curious to know whether people had an experience of a sort of new way of dealing with a situation that maybe before has felt intractable. Has anybody had the experience? Even you don't need to share the whole experience, but just have had it that you've discovered another way through with somebody. Yeah?
Actually,
yes. Yes.
So the person who I was referring to earlier, I believe is a sociopath, and I've googled lots of people do. And I've googled like the characteristics of a sociopath, and basically I came to understand that actually you can't help it. That's it's a mental condition.
Yeah.
No, it's true.
Okay, so well, let's not go argue about the. But yeah.
And then I started to sort of feel like not sorry for him, but I started to realise you just can't help it. That's his brain chemistry or whatever. That's just his nature now, and he can't do anything about it. And so for us, it's to how do we then survive around that.
So again, that's an example of you're trying to fill out your understanding. So, you know, we won't go into the kind of technicalities of it, but because as methodologically, it's like finding a way, isn't it? Mm. And I think that's, I'm labouring this point a bit, because it's like often when we're caught in that kind of hatred and revenge, our options seem quite limited. And I think, like, to me, what meditation has hopefully given me is you start to see that there's sometimes more options. Well, both meditation and kind of reading the lives of inspiring people and the example of people, like seeing people deal with things that seemed undealable with, you know. Yeah, so that's okay. What I'm going to do is, if there's questions now, because there's quite a bit more to get through. So, is there any questions? Yeah.
So it's a question about, well, we're talking about hatred in terms of, you know, very strong terms, but I thought it was more about anything at all that you push away from yourself, whether it's a person, bad shoes, a headache, you feel aversion for.
Yeah. Well, that's back to that point of the, yeah, there can, it can be on a, it can be on a scale. Yeah. If you define it as you're pushing it away. Yeah, that would come under the heading. Yes.
Are you saying that with hatred, just to turn it around, all you've got to do is sort of rationalise and say, well, this person, you know, might have had a bad childhood or because of, you know, various reasons? Because if it was as easy as that, it just seems like you wouldn't hate anybody. You know, that type of thing is that there's, to me, I feel that there's got to be a bit more to it. I'm not saying it has to be more complicated.
It
can't be just you sort of rationalising that actually
they're
going to always
mean,
but it's got
yes, I've certainly not, I hope I'm not giving the impression that it's easy, you know, but it's just like what I was trying to bring out was that a way of work, if we first of all there's identifying it as a painful state for ourselves, and that what we can do to loosen it is to, one way is to try and have a bigger perspective or a broader perspective, and that might be one way to consider the conditions that have led to that. But it's, especially if it's a very, you know, if we have been really hurt or something, you know, that's going to, it's going to take a long time in that way. So in that sense, it does take a long time. You know, and you know, that's why we have practices like the Metta Bhavana that we practice for over long, long periods, because it can't be just an intellectual thing in our minds. We're trying to turn about something that's instinctive, you know, because this behaviour is like, it's instinctive to this kind of pushing away, you know. Yeah. Some people have got their hands up. So what I'd like to do is just keep it to questions just now, because we could keep discussing, and there's just a bit more I want to give. So we'll have Sue Ella, yeah.
Does Buddhism say there is such a thing as categorical, unjustifiable evil? Or does it say that there's, you know, in every situation you can be compassionate? And, you know, send metta to it. Is there any instance where, does it say there is evil?
So, I'm just interested in the link you're making between those two things. So the second thing you said, is there any situation where you couldn't feel metta?
Yeah. For example, to feel something which is standalone.
Okay, so what would be... So let's just take that second bit of the question. So... what would be the consequence of remaining in a state of hatred oneself?
Well, surely hatred towards something which is evil is a useful form of hatred, isn't it?
So... how are you defining hatred?
The will to destroy something.
Okay. So, and what effect? So you've got the will to destroy something. So I'm going to ask you, what effect? What's the consequence of having the will to destroy something in your own mind?
Well, the consequence might be that evil thing is destroyed.
Mm-hmm.
Which is a good outcome.
Mm-hmm.
But how to destroy it?
Okay, let's bring the questions through me. Yeah. Okay, and but what? So let's try and phrase another way of the question. I suppose it's like to destroy something through hatred. I suppose what Buddhism is saying is that hatred. So let's leaving the other person or thing aside at the moment. That will have an effect on your own mind. So that would be the thing that, in a way, Buddhism would ask you to look for yourself at that. So Buddhism isn't going to say you yourself are evil or bad for having that. It's going to ask you to look, well, what effect does having that hatred have on your own mind? So I guess that's, rather than me answering that, I'll answer it by another question. It's asking you or anyone to look at that within your own mind, yeah?
Maybe that is a negative effect for the person who's hating.
Right.
Could you, in some circumstances, say that that's a price to pay?
You can, well,
the ultimate evil gets destroyed, yeah, even though it destroys the person who has to do the destruction.
Well, you could, you know, you could decide that. And I mean, in a way, Buddhism isn't saying anything other than that. It's saying be conscious about what you do. But it also is saying there may be another way. I mean, it's completely up to the individual whether they decide. I mean, one could decide, yes, I'm going to destroy myself, but the price is worth it. In a way, one is free to decide that. But I would say that there is... It's not even just that the price is too high, but that I suppose I would believe that there could be another way through that involved neither allowing oneself to be crushed by whatever the thing was, or allowing oneself to be overcome by a negative mental state, that one could consciously find a way, and that that would be preferable, because if we... In a way, hatred by its nature is going to have ignorance in it. So, because it's a kind of all biting the tail of each other, where you could work for the good. I mean, Buddhism is trying to transform hatred into compassion, not just for ourselves, but for the whole world. And it's, and like one self-feeling hatred, I would say, Buddhism would say, is only adding to the hatred in the world. Whereas you could turn that round. Yeah? Is that... I've got so many hands up, I don't know what to do. Let me just do a time check. Okay. I'm going to call a truce on the hands up just now. Because I would... What I'll do is... And you see, there's loads to discuss in this. But what I'll do is... Because it seems a shame not to give you more of the material from Subhuti. So what I'll do is I'll give you more of that. And then we'll see if there's time for... Save your questions till the end now, yeah? So, what he goes on to say, Subhuti, is that hatred is painful in itself. And he distinguishes that from greed. So, greed, he says, at least has the virtue of promising something good, in a way. And he says, so if you... He says, if you... Buddhism often says that people are inclined one way or the other, you know, so we might be inclined to be what Buddhism would call a greed type, or we'd be inclined to be what Buddhism would call a hate type, and that our propensity is more to one or the other. And so Buddha says, and I think this is true, he says, greed types are probably more pleasant to be with. Whereas if we're disposed to hatred, I'm a hate type, by the way, you might have guessed, because they tend to be more abrasive, then they're going to be more difficult to be with, unfortunately. Because a hate type's not only wanting to do harm, they're also in a state of pain and suffering, which has been drawn out. And the opposite of that, so the non-hatred is the opposite of that. So non-hatred would be the complete absence of a desire to retaliate. It'd be an aversion to aversion. So a Buddha couldn't feel hatred, no matter what sort of ill was going on, no matter what people, a Buddha couldn't feel hatred. But that doesn't mean that the Buddha wouldn't be trying to do something about it. So I think that's important to realise. So the Buddha would feel an aversion to aversion itself. And ultimately that would be metta. What I want to give, because it might help this debate over, is it something, you know, a bit like you were saying, is it something that comes about quickly or slowly? There's four. If hatred is the kind of root poison, as it were. It's like a tree that's got four branches, yeah? So the four branches are fury. So one of them's fury. That's what I get when I just kind of want to... It's quite a hot thing. I think if we're predisposed to a kind of hot rage, we'll know what that feels like. The word in the Buddhist word is krodha, which literally means reaching for the stick. It takes you over and you lose all proportion and reason. Is anybody else disposed to that?
Is that also reaching for the baseball bat?
Yeah. Well, yeah, I'm reaching for anything. I think even the baseball bat, that's a bit premeditated. It's literally, I think it's so quick, it's very, very hot, you know. It's just you'd reach for anything that was handy in it. Yeah, it takes you over. It's quite frightening. I find that somebody predisposed to that, the quickness of it can be quite frightening because you... It's almost like you don't know what you might do, you know.
It's impulsive action.
Yeah, it's very, very impulsive, and it can cause great damage, you know. It can cause great damage that you can't undo. So I think if you're predisposed to that, then, well, for me, I find the practice of mindfulness is indispensable. Somehow, if I notice I'm in that kind of mood, I try and practice more mindfulness. But then there's resentment, and I wonder if this was that's the more slow kind of, I'm pretty much predisposed to this as well actually. So this is where you nurse your hatred. It's concealed within you. It's like you're bearing a grudge, and it's like you're waiting for the occasion to vent it. And that does, it becomes more and more, like you were saying, it builds up. It's bitter, it's a sort of bitterness that you nurse it for, well, years even. And Subhuti was even drawn how it can be handed on from father to son, as it were, from tribe to tribe. So it can actually even be handed on for centuries. So do people know that one, resentment? It's very, I think it can make you ill, resentment, actually. I remember myself once, I was in this situation for about a year that I was unhappy with, but I kind of felt I'd been hard done by. And at the same time, I developed this really bad stomach problem thing. That was really literally, you know, I was literally going to doctor's appointments and stuff. And then an order member came to visit and did a weekend on Metta. And I suddenly realised it was a humiliating but freeing realisation of, oh, I've been nursing resentment for a whole year. And although it was embarrassing, humiliated to realise that, it was freeing, and this whole medical thing I'd had just disappeared overnight. Like, I couldn't believe it, you know. I think it does, eats away at us, doesn't it, resentment. It's definitely... That is definitely poisoning us, I think, more than the other person. The other person doesn't even bloom and know half the time, you know, but we are allowing this to poison ourselves. Subhuti also draws out, it undermines Sangha. If we allow it to take hold within the Sangha, it will undermine what we're trying to do within the Sangha. Then the next traditional one is spitefulness. And Subhuti calls this spikiness. He says the tendency to bite is a kind of snarling. It's like always being in a bad mood. It's an underlying habit, really, of just hatred that's boiling away, just waiting for an excuse to come out. Looking for an excuse, you know. We're almost delighted when we find an excuse and we can snarl.
Sorry,
spitefulness, like ill-wishing the other person, yeah. And you kind of get a release from that by kind of talking to other people about it,
that release.
Yeah. And then the last one, you might be surprised at this coming under hatred, but if you think about it, it does, is envy. And so that's hatred that's stimulated by the success or the good fortune of others. And interestingly enough, it's been called the most antisocial of all the negative emotions, because it's like there's nothing really good to be said about it. Like, a bit like the other forms of hatred, at least you can, like, a bit like Sue Ella was saying, at least you're hating something because they're bad, you know, so at least there's something, you know, at least you can tell yourself that. But to hate somebody because they're good, it's just so shameful in a sense, isn't it? So how could you admit to it, you know? So you tend to keep it secret as well. And then, you know, then it eats away at you even more. The antidote for this, of course, is what a practice that we often do at the Buddhist Centre called rejoicing in merits, like actually going out of your way to rejoice in people's success rather than than envy. So, as I think people have touched on, though, it's important to say that the anger can be positive, and that we need to find positive outlets, in a sense, for our, what you could call our destructive tendencies. Our destructive tendencies might be negative, but there's a kind of energy that does want to change the world, that does want to fight injustice, that does want to see right done. And that can be very hot, you know. So we need to find positive ways of expressing that. At times it might be prudent to exercise some sort of control over ourselves if we're prone to that kind of hot anger. But actually, in the long run, we can't deal with these tendencies in ourselves just by control. We're going to have to find ways of transforming the energy. So all that energy that wants to, in a way, hatred's like the shortcut, in a way. Hatred's like we want to not lose that energy. We want to transform it. So the message of the Dharma is, try and see it as energy and find a way of transforming it, which is not a slow process, as yourself pointed out. You know, it maybe take many, 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 many hours of meditation and reflection and communication. Going on retreat is good, because then we can see it for what it is. So sometimes something might happen in a flash that might change our minds, but more often is something that's slow and going to be transformed. And before we even transform it, we need to be convinced that actually it is a good thing to transform it. So in a way, it's a sort of genuine question I was asking Suella. Like, we need to see, well, is hatred, what effect is this having on my mind? You know, again, it's like the Buddha's always saying, don't just do it because the Buddha told us to. We want to look at our mind and say, well, is this having a positive effect or a negative effect? If we're convinced that it's having a negative effect, then we'll be motivated to change it. But we need to see that for ourselves. You know, we need to look, that's why we meditate and look within and say, well, is it having a negative effect? And if it is, well, that's an interesting question. Is it, maybe it's worth it? You know, well, that's a good question to ask. Is it worth it, or is it not? You know. We've got about 5 minutes. And I know hundreds of people are probably dying to say something. So maybe I will limit it to questions rather than comments, because, you know, you could discuss this kind of thing all night. One could. So, any questions? Yes.
In what you were discussing, in the sort of hatred state, there sort of appears to be no sense of, I don't know if it's control or self-regulation. If I allow this to contaminate me, which is what it is, or if I try and define it by calling it a sociopath or whatever I think I need to justify it, am I not sort of further perpetuating it isn't it better to extract it almost from me and look at it as a separate, not even an emotion, as a separate state, and not have that attachment thing?
So when you say extract it from you,
I mean, I used to be a very angry, really, really hateful, and spent my life just being that way. And it took the death of my father actually to understand that it was so worthless, and I called him every name under the sun and all the rest of it. And it actually took him dying to understand that it was inside me, it wasn't anything to do with him, really. And until I could take it out of me and look at it as something outside of me, I couldn't really. Does that make sense?
So it sounds like, well, it sounds like something transformed, isn't it?
As long as I was engaging with it, hating it, living in it, defining it, giving it names, giving it stereotypes, allowing it to cast this thing over my life and inside me, I was sort of engaging in it. And isn't it about trying to separate me from whatever that thing is that I'm so heavily invested in hating?
What's that?
About being objective.
What were you going to say, Sinapin?
I was just wondering whether what you were indicating was that you were sort of stepping back and saying, this is hatred. I am not hatred.
Absolutely.
This is hatred. So there's one experience of being in it and it doing you and driving you, and there's no objectivity.
No, I can't understand.
You're completely sunk in it. And then there's a process by which we actually, perhaps with some broader awareness and that crucial situation which turns to answer, why do I keep doing this? You know, what's this doing to me and how's it affecting my life? And then we become more objective and say, this is hatred. These behaviours are hatred. And these are the behaviours I'm not going to engage in. I'm putting the brakes on. And I see the process, as it were, of hatred starting. I'm not doing that. Sometimes we have to intervene strongly.
That's
what I mean. Is that what you're getting at?
Good, thank you. Any other questions? Is that a question?
I just wanted to know if there's, like, the word evil was mentioned before. I just wanted to know if you believed in evil. Like, can someone be evil, do you think?
So, what does it mean?
Yeah, because I don't...
Is anyone beyond the pale, sort of?
Yeah, because, you know, it was like, I think a question was asked before, like, is there any situation where you can't empathise with someone? Something, and it was like, if someone's being evil, then it's, you know, you can sometimes hate is good because someone's being evil, so it's a way of attacking the evilness. But then, do you believe in evil? Like, just that somebody can just be doing something just to wrong because they want to just be evil and hate, like someone like Hitler, maybe, as an extreme. Do you think he was evil or?
Well, I don't particularly ask myself that question, to be honest, because I don't know what, in a sense, I don't know where that would get me, asking myself that question.
I always just think that I don't know if I really do believe that anyone can be evil.
But you see what I mean? But maybe I just, we could ask ourselves that. But I would more always come back to myself and think, what is... I would always be trying to work with my own response to whatever situation impinged on me and try and find... So whatever was going to give me more perspective, and by that I don't just mean something intellectually in my mind, but what can... Like, I'm trying to transform hatred into compassion. And that's what I'm concerned about. So I wouldn't, unless it was going to directly help me to do that. I mean, sometimes it can help to, for example, reflect on someone else's circumstances and why they've done such a thing. But in a sense, I'm doing that reflection in order to help to move on my own mental state, emotional state, because what I do believe is that there is a state of being, and that would be the state of being of the Buddha, that whatever happened to him, or whatever happened to any enlightened being, to him or her, whoever they came across in whatever state, that the Buddha would have a creative response to that. So that's what I'm more concerned myself with. How can I strengthen my own metaphor response? Like, at the moment, my metaphor response only goes so far. Like, if people are nice to me, I'll be metaphor back. If they're on a good day, I might be understanding to somebody who isn't nice to me. But what I'm working towards is to try and have a metaphor response, whatever happens. And that's what I do believe is possible. So that's what I'd concern myself with, rather than going around thinking, are other people good or evil or so on.
Yeah.
So it's not that. So there's a particular reason for me not answering the question, and
yeah,
I don't
I
think
suppose
it's
that's
my
kind of silly, because I always just think that if I don't believe that people do things intentionally to be horrible, then it kind of if I'm that kind of helps me to not be angry.
Yeah, well, that's a sort of methodological way. Yeah, so if you're using it in that way, but in the ultimate sense, I would think that even that isn't my concern. My concern is how can I get a bigger, more creative response, yeah? Well, obviously, lots of food for thought in that. It's quite stirring even talking about it in a way, isn't it? And as I say, I'm going to wind up there because it's a minute to quarter to. But if you are interested in the material, I would have a listen to some of those lectures by Subbuti from 2001. You can look at them on Free Buddhist Audio. Some of Sangharakshita's writing on Buddhist ethics, like the 10 Pillars of Buddhism, I'd recommend that as well. And then, yeah, just keep asking yourself that question of what effect is this having on my mind, and therefore, what's this contributing to the world? Okay.